This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Shuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We know from the past that every time activities have been disrupted, that would have a negative impact to the outbreak.
That's WHO spokesman Tarek Jasarevic talking about disruptions in the fight against Ebola in the DRC. Details coming up.
Also today in Sudan, police fired on protesters in Khartoum and the city of Omdurman as they marched and chanted demands for President Omar al-Bashir to resign. And the U.S. says it is concerned about reports of vote buying ahead of Nigeria's election.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Congo opposition candidate Martin Fayulu says he will file a legal challenge to the official results of the country's presidential election. Speaking in Kinshasa today, Fayulu said he will do so at the Constitutional Court tomorrow morning. Congo's Electoral Commission declared that another opposition candidate, Felix Tshisekedi, won the December 30th election. Fayulu's campaign says it has tallies showing he finished on top with 61% of the vote. The Catholic Church and foreign diplomats have also questioned the outcome of the poll. The church said yesterday that the official figures do not correspond to vote tallies collected by its 40,000 election observers around the country. Fayulu and Tshisekedi were competing to replace outgoing President Joseph Kabila, who was set to step down after 18 years in power, 2 years after his last term expired. Well, to help put these latest developments into perspective, joining us live in the studio is Abdourahami Dia of VOA's French to Africa service. Welcome, Abdou.
Thank you, Kim.
Well, Abdou, Fayulu supporters, they've accused President Kabila of making a deal with the Electoral Commission to deny him the presidency. Is there any truth to this?
I don't know, but I was there until the end of last week, and the rumor actually starting, going big on these backdoor talks and deals between Tshisekedi and Kabila's people. And they think that someone has been instrumental in that, and that is Vital Kamerhe, who is an ally of Tshisekedi, but who is also in the inner circle of Kabila up until recently. So he still have friends in the inner circle of Kabila, but he's running with Tshisekedi, and people think that he has been the one who has been instrumental, whether there is any truth to that. But actually, if you look at the coalition running the country right now, they have been accepting the result and saying that they are willing to work with Tshisekedi. And Tshisekedi himself has said that, he will need their expertise. So they didn't go as far as saying that they struck a deal. But when you hear both parties talking, you can say that there is definitely, something going on there.
Well, also, this could be the DRC's first peaceful democratic transfer of power since their independence in 1960. But observers warn that a court challenge to these results could spin the country into chaos. So is Fayulu making the right move?
Right now, I think he is, because legally he can do that up until tomorrow. And then also he did ask his supporters to stay mobilized and be vigilant to make sure that their victory, quote-unquote, is not being stolen. But right now, everybody, including the international community, is calling for challenges to go through the court.
Now, careful statements by the international community. They have not congratulated Tshisekedi, merely taking note of the official results and urging peace and stability. So how is this being perceived in the country?
Right. And I think a lot of people have noticed that also, that kind of cautious. Maybe they just want to wait and see what the court will say and, to see what happened. But it is, in fact, unusual to see that everybody is being cautious. And given the fact that Senko, the church, which is a very credible institution there, has already said even before the election that they know who the winner was, and basically the embassies knew that they were talking about Fayulu. So people are very doubtful whether really Tshisekedi is a real winner. And I think that's why everybody's being cautious.
So ultimately, then, what is the mood on the ground right now, and how are people feeling about the election?
From talking to people there, you know, really people want to see what will come next. They are, at the same time, it is not the candidate of the ruling party. In that sense, you know, it's like, you know, they are relieved. At least those who are hoping for change are relieved. But at the same time, they're still questioning whether this is the real winner or not, because the church already said they don't think he is. And the church has been at the center of this whole process since 2016 at the cost of lives. They have been calling for protests so they can have peaceful elections and democratic elections. So if they say something and they have 40,000 people on the ground, people do listen to what they have to say.
And so, as you mentioned, it is unusual, too, that this is not the ruling party. This is an opposition candidate who,
right,
you know, they are questioning.
And that's why I think Fayulu is walking a fine line. At the same time, people want to change, but it's not him, maybe. You know, how do you deal with that? If it was Shadari who was declared the winner, it would be much easier to mobilize people because they know that he's not popular.
Okay, thank you so much, Abdul. Appreciate that. And that was Abdul Raham Media of VOA's French to Africa service.
International aid agencies are waiting to see if disruptions in their activities due to election-related violence in the eastern DRC will cause a spike in new Ebola infections. Medical staff were forced to stay inside for several days as violence broke out when the central government announced that presidential voting in the area would be delayed until March due to the outbreak that began at the end of July. Voting went ahead in the rest of the country, and the winner already has been announced. Shutdowns from previous violence has led to increases in new cases because of the impact in tracking people who may have been infected with the deadly disease, and the government's decision to shut down internet access in the country caused concerns that people fleeing the area, commuting to Uganda and Rwanda to get online, could allow Ebola to jump borders. So far, there have been 630 confirmed and possible cases, including 385 deaths. My colleague Paul Alexander spoke with WHO spokesman Tarik Jasarvich about the situation.
What we have seen in the past week or two is that there is a decrease in number of new cases in Mbeni, which was one of the hotspots of this outbreak, especially in past couple of months. But we have to be very careful how we interpret these numbers, because we know that around elections or just before the elections in DR Congo, there were disruptions in the response activities by Ministry of Health, WHO, and other partners. And we may see reflection of this disruption in weeks to come. But definitely one explanation could be that that strong work that has been put in place in Beni is maybe paying off. But again, we have to be cautious on how we analyze this this trend.
So what was the impact that you're aware of from the latest disruptions?
Well, we still have to wait to see if we will get new cases, positive cases for Ebola that do not come from the contact list or that come from a contact list of people who could not have been followed. So we still don't have that, but we know from the past that every time activities have been disrupted, that would have a negative impact to the outbreak. However, even during those disruption days, we tried to do our best to cover certain activities, such as contact tracing, even though our teams were not able to go there, through the community workers, we were managing to get some information and to investigate alerts. However, vaccination has stopped for a couple of days. Now all the work is fully in place. It's resumed completely, and we are back into 100% mode. But again, all the gains that have been made could be lost if we face again prolonged period of insecurity where we are not able to go where we need to go.
Are there concerns about the number of people who are crossing over into neighboring countries, particularly Uganda, to be able to get online?
There is a concern from the beginning of this outbreak that people who have contracted the virus may travel to neighboring countries, especially those who are really nearby, Rwanda, Uganda, and eventually South Sudan. This is why the preparedness work has started early on in the outbreak. All neighboring countries have set up a preparedness system of screening people coming from DR Congo, investigating any suspect cases, having in place isolation facilities, having a workforce that is trained. Uganda has started vaccination of health workers who work near the border with DR Congo. South Sudan is planning to do the same. So this preparedness work has been very strong since the beginning. And we think that countries, especially Uganda and Rwanda, have a health system that would be ready to quickly detect and respond to any possible travel. More than 25 million travelers have been screened so far at the border crossing, but also inside the DR Congo on a major road.
That was WHO spokesman Tarek Jasarvich speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander.
Eight years ago, the Arab Spring brought hope for the viability of democratic governance in Muslim, Arab, and North African countries. But with the exception of Tunisia, the other Arab Spring countries reacted to popular dissent with authoritarian crackdowns or ended up in civil wars. Still, many regional experts see a future for a slow transition to democracy in North Africa. VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi has the story.
The popular uprisings that erupted in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and Syria in 2011 produced mixed results. Libya, Syria, and Yemen have been trapped in military conflict. Tunisia is proceeding with a slow transition to democracy. Egypt witnessed an initial push toward a democratic transition, but ended with a military takeover following the failure of the brief Muslim Brotherhood-led government. Ambassador David Mack is the former Deputy U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East.
Egypt and Tunisia both had sets of considerable institutions. The problem was that in Egypt, the military institution dominated all the others. A military alternative was the obvious one in the minds of a lot of Egyptians. Fortunately, in Tunisia, there were other alternatives to turning toward a military, and let it be said that the Tunisian military performed its part of helping the country get on its feet after the fall of Ben Ali.
Mack says while Libya has plenty of resources, it failed miserably since the revolution of 2011 because it started with almost none of public institutions that a democracy needs, and it hasn't been able to build them with the country divided between warring factions. The Arab Spring uprisings began in late December 2011 in Tunisia, and on January 14, 2011, President Zinedine Ben Ali resigned and fled the country. The protests spread across to other countries in North Africa and the Arab world. Radwan Masmoudi, president of Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, says a transition to democracy needs patience.
Democracy is not a goal in itself, but it's the only way to make sure that the government is accountable to the people and they have to deliver. But it takes time. You know, these problems that we inherited in over 6 years are not going to be fixed in 1 or 2 years because the reforms take time.
But a recent public opinion poll in Egypt and Tunisia shows many people there are not optimistic about their country's futures. James Ogbi, president of the Arab American Institute, which did the poll, noted that confidence in public institutions is quite low. He said only 26% of Tunisians had confidence in the police, 25% in the parliament, and 10% in the media. He said the Egyptian confidence levels were not much better, especially regarding the army.
After the military took over, there was an initial wave of support, but numbers have continued to go down, and the country right now is probably very decidedly divided on the question of whether the government is performing well.
Zoghbi says top priorities for Tunisians and Egyptians are job opportunities, ending corruption, and improving education and health care. Democratic transition was not a top priority. Tamara Son, professor of Islamic history at Georgetown University, says a lack of economic development and job creation hampers the ability of post-Arab Spring governments to meet public expectations.
Instability comes from lack of basic goods, but there's great resistance to investing in an unstable context, and that investment is essential for creating stability.
Not all is doom and gloom in Tunisia. Masmoudi at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy says one of the major successes in Tunisia was a new constitution and elections law, which prevents any party from having the majority in the parliament. Under the law, no party can have more than 40% of the seats in the parliament. Masmoudi says, on the other hand, there is a move in Egypt to change its 2014 constitution to allow President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to stay beyond the current limit of 2 terms. He says that is a step backward, repeating the past mistakes that allowed former President Hosni Mubarak to rule Egypt for 30 years until he was forced out in the Arab Spring. Mohammed El-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhib. 22 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Congo opposition candidate Martin Failulu says he will file a legal challenge to the official results of the country's presidential election. Meanwhile, international aid agencies are waiting to see if disruptions in their activities due to election-related violence in the eastern DRC will cause a spike in new Ebola infections. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The U.S. says it is concerned about reports of vote buying ahead of Nigeria's election and says insecurity and partisanship by the security forces could challenge the integrity of the vote. At a U.N. Security Council session yesterday, U.S. Deputy Ambassador Jonathan Cohen urged Nigerian leaders to ensure the election is free and fair. Nigerian election officials this week acknowledged a problem with politicians buying people's voter cards and said steps are being taken to prevent vote buying. President Muhammadu Buhari is running for a second term in the February 16th election. He has dozens of rivals, but his strongest challenger is former Vice President Atiku Abubakar. In addition to problems with the integrity of the process, there has been a surge in attacks by the Boko Haram militants in the northeast. Late last month, more than 30,000 people fled their homes in the Lake Chad region after attacks by the militant Islamists.
Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission says some politicians have been buying people's permanent voter cards or paying voters to give out their identification numbers. The commission says politicians may buy the cards to prevent the owners from voting, since voters must show the cards to cast a ballot. Dr. Williams Wadi is an African Affairs analyst at the University of Port Harcourt. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about the implications of buying voter cards for the election. He says politicians buying the cards have failed to sell their proposals to the electorate.
Well, the annex chamber should know this is an act of desperation on the side of politicians from across the parties. And so this is also a clear sign that they have not been able to sell their messages or whatever constitutes their party manifesto to the electorate. And so the act of desperation is driving them to purchasing PVCs, that's permanent voters' cards, in the kind of in exchange for some kind of gratification. And this shows that they've not been able to reach the electorate.
What could be the aim of buying the cards or getting the identification numbers?
The aim of buying the cards, the aim of getting the identification number, they all serve the same purpose. It is to ensure that those people are tracked right down to the polling booths, and so they can give them some peanuts and then get them to vote for them. But unfortunately, the issue here is that INEC had told us repeatedly that they have enough technological base to counter this absolutely unacceptable or anti-democratic act of not persuading voters to vote for you rather than going back to purchase their cards. That's absolutely unacceptable. It's undemocratic. It's not part of democratic culture. And the politicians who engage in this type of act know it. And so what they are doing is what their colleagues are doing, the other parties too. So the shameful thing here is that all the parties, without exception, are doing the same thing.
Do you think INEC can sanction identified politicians involved in the act?
The problem of our country, Nigeria, is not the absence of laws or legislation. The problem is enforcement. It is practically impossible, in my opinion, for INEC to sanction them because the mass pool of people who engage in this cut across the parties, with about 94 parties, at least with a sizable number of them, close to 30-something fielding presidential candidates. How can INEC? INEC simply doesn't have the sheer logistic backup to individually identify them across the countries in the 774 local government areas, identifying each of them and then attempting to sanction them. The logistics is not there. And then again, the prosecutorial powers of INEC has not been exercised for a long time, if you ask me. So I am almost certain that INEC is merely standing by and watching. I don't think INEC can sanction them because it would lack all the logistics to do so.
What measures should INEC adopt to prevent the use of compromised cards for the election?
You recall that INEC had talked about transmitting results electronically to its headquarters. If that were perfected, a kind of technological backup, it would be difficult for these cards to count. But the way it is right now, INEC, from the last I heard from the chairman, will manually transmit collect results. What that simply means is that at some point, desperate politicians who have enough money to bribe ignorant voters will ultimately have their way, and I doubt if INEC can do beyond merely hoping that they can conduct a free and fair election. On the part of INEC, I'm almost certain that they are determined to conduct free and fair elections, but that it is the political class that has made it impossible for INEC to conduct elections. Unfortunately, in our country, they turn around to blame INEC for the same crimes they are perpetuating against the electoral system and against the voters and undermining the democratic process. So I think that INEC can try, INEC should try, and what INEC can do is to ensure that it does the minimum. It does everything possible to get the democratic process, make it a credible, free and fair, transparent election, and then hope that the political class, out of desperation, may not truncate the system.
And that was Williams Wardy, an African Affairs analyst at the University of Port Harcourt. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye in Port Harcourt, Nigeria. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Zubair Taieb, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.